Well, good day, and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's good to have you all joining us again this week. We're back this week with part two of a two-part episode that began last week, so my introduction will be pretty short, which you'll probably all appreciate. We're going to be jumping back in with our discussion of ski patrol training and tactics and how they manage disaster-like situations and mass casualty or potential mass casualty incidents in the ski industry and in the ski patrol arena. And of course, we have our resident weather expert and ski patroller, Kyle Nelson, joining us, as well as, of course, my co-host, Sam Bradley, and Dr. Joe Holly on the call. So we're gonna pick up now with that call with Sam, and Sam is asking the very next question to Kyle to find out what we can do to better manage patients in the cold environments seen by ski patrollers.
And we want to talk about, there's just so many issues around, and this is stuff both for patrollers as well as skiers as far as mountain safety. So we talk about chairlifts, helmets. Joe's got some points he wants to make on harnesses, which nobody really thinks about too much. Injuries to patrollers. There's just a whole bunch of stuff. So why don't you jump in there, Kyle? Pick one and let's go for it. And I'm sure Joe and Jamie will have some questions too.
Awesome. So let's start right off the top with chairlift safety for our on-mountain topics. And well, this is, you know, January, and it is skier safety month. You know, these should be things that are going on, you know, throughout the season, things that you practice, as well as if you're skiing, say, in the southern hemisphere during the North American summertime. One, I'm super jealous. And two, be sure to practice these down there as well. So with chairlifts, the first thing, the biggest thing is, you know how to load and unload the chairlift properly. If you're not sure, talk to the lift operators. One, they're pretty cool folks. And two, you know, they will be able to walk you through how to load that chairlift effectively and unload it. And if you ask, and if you want to, if say you're a beginner skier, you're not really comfortable with chairlifts, many of the detachable chairlifts that we use, the more modern ones, you can actually request to have them slowed down if you would like, so you can get more comfortable with it. Second thing is, when you're loading that lift, make sure, please, 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 remove those the pole straps if you have ski poles, as well as backpacks. We were talking here about some of the recent chairlift related incidents involving backpacks and people, you know, falling from the lift for one reason or another, and, you know, hanging by their backpack straps. And that can result in, you know, any number of injuries, as we can talk about with the harness injury or suspension injuries piece. But hold those in your lap, and, you know, it's not going to kill you to take a couple seconds to put that backpack back on and reattach it when you're safely off the lift, and it could potentially, you know, save you from getting tangled in those backpack straps, you know, if something were to go wrong, perhaps when you're unloading the lift, if one of those gets caught in a little pinch point on the chair, it could perhaps take you for a ride that you were not expecting up at the top. Also, as you're riding on the lift, use that safety bar. It may not be the cool thing to do, but I'll tell you what, it saves your legs. It's a good place to rest your skis, your snowboard, or your feet if you're riding up on foot. But also, and we've seen several incidences of this across the U.S., not necessarily recently, but if someone were to have a medical emergency and you were to perhaps, you know, go unconscious or not be able to control your movements, that chairlift safety bar would more than likely prevent you from falling out of that chairlift. And so that's a very important piece. And finally, never, ever jump out of the chair. Yes, those chairs go over some pretty cool terrain that looks really awesome to ski or ride. But at least in the state of Colorado, where I'm based, it is it's against the law to jump from a chairlift. And if you're caught, you can be charged with a misdemeanor for one kind of misdemeanor for every person who was on that lift at the time that you jumped, because you just endangered not only your life jumping from that chair, but also the lives of all the other passengers on that chair, because jumping from a lift can possibly disable that lift. It could cause it to suddenly stop if it trips a safety sensor, or even at the worst, perhaps derail a chairlift. And so definitely things to keep in mind.
Wow, I did not know that in Colorado. That's really interesting, and it makes a lot of sense. Are you a skier, Joe? I don't think I ever asked you that.
I have not been skiing in a very long time, so I would say that I would be a very poor skier and is likely to come take me down the mountain.
You're the guy that would go around the bull wheel because you can't remember how to get off the lift?
Yes.
We would hate to think that. But, yeah, that happens once in a while, or the guy behind you doesn't know how to stop and knocks you over right after you get off the lift. There's all kinds of fun stuff like that. So what about safety gear, Kyle? Helmets, other things like that, both for skiers and for patrollers. Any thoughts on that?
So the best piece of gear that you can bring with you is your brain. And that's one of the biggest things is you should not ski or ride when you're impaired, whether that's by alcohol, whether that's by other mind-altering substances. You know, if you're not 100% on your game, you're not only risking, you know, your life, but perhaps the lives of others if you should crash into them. And I'm a huge proponent of this. And also we're now, as mountain employees, we're required to wear helmets at the resort that I work at. And that's really my big piece is on helmets because, you know, even a minor concussion or on the extreme end, a traumatic brain injury from your head striking the snow, another person, or perhaps a fixed object, whether it be man-made or natural, could be potentially life-altering. And that's not something that we really want to gamble with. You know, we all want to, you know, have a good time. We want to ski and ride safely. But just keeping in mind that, you know, even if we're confident in our abilities, Sam, as you kind of hinted at, we also need to be aware that there are others, perhaps skiing or riding, that may not be completely in control. And so wearing helmets is a big piece. And I look at it as a pretty cheap insurance policy. And just about all resorts that I've ever been to now, if you don't bring a helmet, you forget it one day, go to the rental shop. You can just rent a helmet for the day. And if that one time renting the helmet, you spend a few bucks on that, and if that keeps you from, you know, getting a head injury if you fall on the hard snow, that's a pretty good investment in my mind. And you might say, well, you know, I've been doing pretty good so far. I like the freedom, the feeling of wind in my hair. And I would just bring up very briefly someone who I believe this was back in 2008 or 2009. You may remember Natasha Richardson, who was skiing up at a resort in Quebec, up in Canada. She fell, hit her head while she was in a beginner ski lesson. It wasn't necessarily a high-speed fall, but initially she seemed fine. But later on, started getting a headache after she got back to her hotel room. And it turned out she actually had some bleeding on her brain that because she refused to go and get seen and go and get checked out, she ultimately, unfortunately, ended up dying from those injuries. So, you know, it's not, you know, we're not invincible, and we need to be responsible and safe when we're out skiing and riding.
Yeah, and that kind of segues into something else I was thinking about in terms of helmets and so forth. But as we get older, we're more highly predisposed to subdurals, which is something to be said for that. But, you know, the whole helmet thing, I think, really got kicked off all those many years ago when Sonny Bono ran into a tree. And then the whole helmet thing started. And Joe, what I remember about that, there was a huge controversy on helmets for kids, the theory being, you know, a kid's head is like a bowling ball on a broomstick. You know, you got all this extra weight up there, and now you're going to add a helmet to it. Is that going to predispose a kid to a neck injury in certain situations? And there was all this controversy going back and forth. Now, I assume since then, and this is 20, 30 years ago, that helmets are lighter and more streamlined and you know, easier and better for kids to have. But, you know, what are your thoughts on that? And then I'd like to hear from Kyle on what's currently out there for kids.
Yeah, I think you're right, Sam. The helmets definitely appear to have won that argument. I don't know that there's any hardcore empiric research around that, but certainly the quality of the helmets has improved quite a bit, and the concerns, especially in recent years, over concussions in kids has really pushed helmets to the forefront, and this is a classic situation where you need one. You know, the other prominent person I can think of from a skiing accident is Michael Schumacher, the Formula One multi-champion, who has been essentially devastated neurologically from a brain injury related to a skiing accident.
Wow, I wasn't even aware of that one. Yeah, it's and kids are fearless. I mean, you put a two-year-old on a pair of skis and he's gone, and they're closer to the ground. So, you know, in most cases, they don't have that fear of falling that we adults may have. So that's another thing there. You know, you put them in their first lesson and they're gone. So, you know, what's your thoughts on the equipment that's out there right now for kids, Kyle?
The equipment that's out there for kids right now has it's come a long way, and both for kids and adults. Not only in the helmets, they're, you know, lighter, they're more streamlined. There's been, you know, extensive research and testing to make the helmets more able to absorb an impact and dissipate that. So there's better materials in there now. But also, the bigger thing is that the ski equipment in general has gotten better, and so the bindings have gotten that technology has improved. So they're more likely to release in a fall to, you know, decrease the chance of, you know, a leg or a lower limb injury. Also, some of the other equipment that's out there now, like the boots, are better designed to prevent, you know, and they're designed to really mold to the feet a lot better to help prevent some of the twisting injuries or perhaps ankle injuries that would occur within the boot, unlike in years or decades past. So it's come a long way, and a lot of safety features have been integrated into there in the newer equipment. So it's definitely something. If you have some older ski or snowboard equipment, definitely look at, you know, some of the newer things that are out there, some of the newer technologies, and not only for performance, but also for safety as well.
So I'm going to put Jamie on the spot here because he's been awfully quiet in the background. So you're on a ski lift, you're a beginning skier, and you're on the lift with an older person who has the big one while you're up there. Now, you're a nurse and a medic, so I know medically you'd know what to do, even though there's not much you could do on the lift itself. But how would you and who would you alert to let them know that there's a medical emergency and when this lift gets to the bottom, this person is not going to be able to get off? What would you do?
Well,
gotcha.
It's been a long time since I've been skiing, so it's hard for me to. And as I recall, I always had issues getting off the lift myself. So I can't imagine. I mean, you've got to alert the people on the lift as you approach the top or the bottom to let them know that they've got to stop the lift when you get to the bottom. You've got a medical emergency. I mean, that's what you've got to do. If you're mid transit or stopped for some reason, that's when you have to pull out your phone. Hopefully you have it accessible and you don't drop it, that you can make a call and reach emergency services that way. But you said it right. There's no way to really treat somebody in the middle of the ride. You've got to, you're not going to do CPR up there. You're not going to be able to manage anything other than just to keep the person as calm as possible and if they're alert at all, and ride to the end of that segment of the ride, alerting staff immediately as soon as you can from a distance, if possible, so that they're prepared for emergency when you get to that point in the lift, so that they can get you off and help you, and you can assist them if they need it to get the other person off the lift, and then care can begin. This is a situation where you can't really manage care until you get the person down. And I assume that's correct, right, Kyle?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Even if it was a patroller that was riding the lift with someone who, for this particular scenario, you know, having, say, a cardiac event or, you know, any type of medical emergency, there's, you know, very little that we could do to manage that patient on the lift. The biggest thing would be to, we would have radios to contact our dispatch. If you're riding with someone, the first thing I do before I go out to a new resort for the day is I would grab a trail map, first thing I do is look for what the number is, because almost every resort I've ever been to, somewhere on that trail map, you can find a direct line phone number for ski patrol, or at least like a mountain switchboard that could put you in contact with them. Worst case, 911 is a great option, because they'll have those hot transfers available to link you to that mountain's dispatch. But from on that lift, just keeping them from falling out of the lift is a big one. If the safety bar is not already down, if you can kind of hold that person back, bring that safety bar down. And as you said, be loud, be vocal, you know, get the attention of other skiers or riders below you. Tell them to say, hey, call ski patrol. You know, this, you know, someone, you know, something's not right. We have an emergency. And of course, getting up to the top, those lift operators, they're very attentive. If they see you screaming, waving and shouting, they'll know that something's up, and they'll be able to alert ski patrol and get us rolling that way very, very quickly.
Okay, Joe, here's a scenario for you, and take you back to your skiing day. So it's about 22 degrees. You're up on the lift, and it stops. You got some little kid next to you. How long, and it's snowing. So, and Kyle, I want your thoughts on this too, but how long will it be before hypothermia starts becoming a problem, and how will you know that?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I think the issue there is you're exposed from all sides. You have wind chill to deal with. And with temperatures like that, obviously it depends a little bit on how heavily insulated you are. But you could begin becoming hypothermic within some number of minutes. And certainly if you were stuck there for an hour or two, you'd certainly likely be getting in trouble. And that may be manifested initially by just some confusion and poor judgment. You know, folks that are progressively becoming fairly hypothermic tend to do all kinds of things, like begin removing most of their protective clothing and are confused and have concentration difficulties, as well as communication and sort of subtle neurological signs, moving toward ultimately just being non-responsive altogether. So that could easily be confused with someone who's had a little too much to drink or was panicking or anything else, and presents quite a challenge for those trying to get to those people.
And of course, alcohol is a a whole different subject. And I'm going to ask Kyle a question, but I'll get back to you, Joe, on the effects of alcohol, because somehow we have that myth of the Saint Bernard with the brandy around his neck, and then that's a good thing to deal with, you know, cold weather issues, which I think that's actually not true. But you know, what are your thoughts on that, Kyle? Because as Joe's talking, I'm thinking about, okay, so you got these 80 people on this lift. What if it was the worst case scenario conditions? Now you got these people that are all getting hypothermic and not functioning properly. That is going to create a huge problem for patrollers in terms of trying to communicate with them and helping get them off the lift. And they might be doing things that are dangerous simply because they're not thinking straight. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Sam, I think that's an absolutely valid point and a valid concern. Again, with our scenario that we had at our mountain, our lift evacuation, we were very fortunate to have fair weather. Where on the flip side, with the scenario that you just gave us, it's one that I would never wish to happen for any resort ever. But of course, you know, with our sending our initial line skier down the line, we would identify those very young or very old, perhaps sick patients, or those that are injured in some way, and that would allow us from an operations point of view to prioritize who we're going to evacuate first. And, you know, we had, you know, a couple of chairs with our chairlift evacuation that had, you know, younger children in them. And so we prioritized those spans. So a span is the cable when it rides between two towers. That's what we call a span. And so those spans would get evacuated first so that we could get those children down, since they, of course, in a smaller body mass, are a little bit more susceptible to wind chill, things like that, that could ultimately lead to hypothermia. I thought that was an excellent explanation of hypothermia and how things can progress from, you know, mild to bad to worse. But definitely, one of the things as we go down the lift line, having people put the safety bar down, even just lifting your feet up and resting it on that safety bar improves the blood flow through the legs. It'll keep your feet warmer, is what a lot of people found, and we told us and thanked us for telling them that. But also, you know, if you have, you know, any extra layers, any gear in your backpack to put on, you know, put the goggles on, zip up, you know, pull that balaclava up and just kind of hunker down and kind of almost kind of turtle up, as it were, and just kind of sit there and hold on.
Good stuff. So, Joe, alcohol and cold weather. What is the myth? What is the reality?
Well, you've touched on the myth, and that's that alcohol will warm you up, and certainly it gives you a nice warm sensation as it goes down. But unfortunately, it's a vasodilator in many cases, which means you're going to lose heat more quickly. Clearly, it's going to affect your mental capacity and your judgment so that you do things that you might not do otherwise, which may hasten your own cooling. So in reality, alcohol is not at all beneficial in a cold situation.
Yeah, wait till the end of the day and then sit in front of the fire and have your hot toddies. That would be a good thing. So, Joe, can you give us a little bit of a rundown on the differences between frostnip, frostbite, you know, freezing of tissues? How does one know when you're really in trouble? I mean, I have my own experience on that, but I don't know that people know the differences between those various stages of freezing extremities and what, if anything, maybe Kyle can jump in on that. Can we do about it?
Well, it's definitely a continuum, you know, from the sense of beginning to lose the sensation in the tissues to actual freezing inside the cellular matrix of the tissue, which is obviously going to result in tissue death. So clearly the best treatment here is preventative. If you get into a situation where you feel like you have frostbite and, you know, you've lost sensation in fingers or toes and the color is changing and they obviously feel quite cold, et cetera, then you know, you want to be careful how you rewarm those. You don't want to warm them up a little bit and then have them refreeze at some other time. So there's an awful lot of issues around that. I think the general hypothermia concern has to do with some of the stuff we had talked about earlier with changes in judgment and mental status. Confusion and anxiety and all kinds of rather generic neuro findings. But you also have to be worried about people's cardiovascular status as they get extremely cold and the risk of ventricular fibrillation or a lethal arrhythmia in the heart is much greater when the body is very cold and is not generally very amenable to medications or treatment at all. So we aggressively try to warm those people up before we try to, you know, restore normal heart rhythms and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and you're reminding me of a couple of things. First of all, we vasoconstrict when we're cold, so that's why your nose and your toes and your fingers end up, you know, getting frozen first. I had another good question for you on that. Well, I do remember, too, that when you have a serious frostbite, when it thaws out, it is like a huge second-degree burn. I mean, they swell up, and it hurts like hell. So if you're going to rewarm anything, be prepared for that. Kyle, what are your thoughts on that?
I think the biggest thing is just prevention of these injuries and, you know, any kind of cold injury. So if your extremities, your fingers are starting to get cold, maybe your toes are starting to get numb in your boots and you can't feel them anymore, or your feet are feeling cold, stop in, you know, one of the buildings at the resort, you know, warm up, you know, take the gloves off and prevent that, you know, the frost nip from going to, you know, frost bite, because it's not fun to deal with once you get to that level. And you know, another thing is making sure you have, again, the right gear, you know, investing even in a like a little like a buff or, you know, even wearing a bandana over, you know, your mouth and nose can prevent the tip of your nose from getting frostbitten. And I always bring, you know, a second pair of gloves if I'm out there. I'm going to be out there, say, for an all day ski run or an all day ski or activity. just because those gloves, they're going to get the moisture from your hands on the inside, perhaps the snow on the outside. Having a fresh pair of gloves to change into can make all the difference between a really great day skiing and riding or a really bad day.
And dry socks. Always carry extra dry socks. Joe, lastly, the last question we have time for is I want to touch on harness injuries because I think that's important and something that people forget about. You want to touch on that?
Well, I'll try to capture that fairly quickly. You know, the concern there is folks who are wearing harnesses of some sort, and that can include sort of impromptu harnesses like backpacks and some of that kind of stuff. When they are suspended by those devices, the straps on those harnesses or backpacks or whatever often function like tourniquets. And so after a relatively brief period of time of being suspended, folks begin to pool a significant amount of their blood volume in their extremities. Certainly if their legs are down, then, you know, they pool a tremendous amount of blood in there. And in many cases can end up with ischemia in their lower extremities because the blood supply has been impeded quite a bit, and that can lead to a syndrome that looks pretty much like crush syndrome, where you build up a lot of toxins in the periphery, and then as those folks are released and, you know, brought down from that and the straps are loosened, et cetera, they restore their circulation and they flush all that stuff into their central circulation and have many of the same problems that we see in crush syndrome. So it's not something we think about very often, but it is absolutely a deadly consequence of a significant hanging injury in some sort of harness.
Wow, really good to know. Jamie, any last thoughts or questions?
No, I think we've covered quite a bit in this double episode that we've done here with Kyle and Joe. I'm just fascinated, you know, it's having not been in the position to be a responder in that particular situation. It's always interesting to hear the myriad of concerns that are dealt with. You know, you don't think about fires and things like that when you think about ski patrol, but you're absolutely right. When the emergency presents and you're the responder on the scene, whatever that emergency might be, you need to be prepared for it. And it goes back to something I always talk about in this show and others that I do is really understanding the emergencies that can present for you in a given region or at a given time of year, and that preparedness and thinking ahead about what you would do in a given situation often can help out, but it doesn't take the place of really good training.
Absolutely. And of course, Joe knows this better than anyone because he and Jim Logan, the Sasquatch, do this for a living. They have an organization that does training on everything from active shooter to maybe now they'll add snow injuries. Who knows? Anything you need, they're prepared to do it for you. So we'll talk a little bit in a minute about how you would find out more about Paragon and what they do. So, Kyle, this is fascinating, and it's taken me back a few years and remembering the good, bad, and the freezing to death and wishing we could go inside. So it certainly has its ups and downs. Any final thoughts from you on this myriad of topics?
Well, I think to wrap up this topic on ski patrol and lift evacuation and, you know, all those types of things, I think it's just important to remember that no matter which resort you go to, and if you're a skier, a snowboarder, a snow biker, whichever equipment that you're on for the day, you know, just know that, you know, whether it's a volunteer team or a paid team of patrollers or a combination thereof, they're dedicated folks that are out there to keep you and all the other guests at that mountain safe. And again, they're not just ski cops to get you for riding too fast or to fix you up if you have a bad day. But, you know, they're normal people. You know, stop in, talk to them, stop in the ski patrol shack and say hi. You never know who you're going to meet there and if you might make some new friends. And, you know, definitely be sure to thank them for what they do out there. Because, again, as we talked about, there's a lot that ski patrol does behind the scenes to keep the mountains safe that, and so that you can have a great day with yourself, your family, your friends, and so that you can keep coming back for more.
And many of them are volunteers too. I just wanted to throw that in.
Yeah, absolutely. It's important.
Yes, go ahead, Jamie.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I just was going to say, you know, the so, you know, as always, one of the underlying topics we've talked about is training and preparation and prevention. And I think those are all key topics that Joe and the team at Paragon really focus on. And it always is important for us to remember that they help sponsor the Disaster Podcast, make it possible for us to bring these episodes out to you on these various topics. And Joe, I love hearing Kyle talk about the amount of preparation and forethought and training that went into them being ready to manage things like a major lift evacuation. And it's really about systems like that, like ski resorts and local jurisdictions, all really taking that preparedness and that training to task and making sure that they've got it on hand.
Oh, I completely agree. And of course, Kyle is a true professional at that. And, you know, it shows in how well that operation he described went. But only when you hear about all the intricacies of that can you appreciate how much work it takes and how much preparation it takes. You know, certainly from a training standpoint, that's our thing. And we love to see when good training really pays off.
Where can folks find out more about Paragon Medical Education Group, the type of training you do, maybe get an overview of what kind of things you have going on?
Well, they can find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or our Facebook page, Paragon Medical Group. Our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU, and you can always catch up with us through the Disaster Podcast website or the Disaster Podcast Facebook page.
And we do appreciate all your support and continued support here of bringing the show to folks. And we urge the listeners to spread the word, talk about what kind of training opportunities are out there, and reach out to Paragon. Jim and Joe are very accessible and want to work with your organization to bring the specific kind of training and work with you to create a really special situation and training scenario that is going to be perfect for what your system needs. So take advantage of the opportunity to reach out to them and pick their brain a little bit and find out what they can do for you. Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. I'm out there, always happy to continue the conversation here. If you have questions or thoughts, you want to connect with me, you can do that on those realms, as well as you can also find me lurking, I guess, on the Disaster Podcast Facebook group and on the forums on disasterpodcast.com.
And Sam, how about you?
Well, the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. And as both Joe and Kyle have said, lurking on the Facebook page for the Disaster Podcast, as well as the website. And we talked about great stuff tonight. So I think we're going to try and post some of this and some of the Ski Patrol Facebook pages that I'm on, because I think this is good for everybody. But if you have any good good questions on weather or ski patrol or anything else that because Kyle is so multifaceted, please jump up there and ask those questions, and I'm sure he'd be glad to ask it. Joe, you had some last comment to make?
I just wanted to give a quick shout out to our friend Kevin to make sure his recovery is going well.
I believe it is. He went back to work very quickly. For those of you that haven't heard, our friend Kevin had a little heart issue occur a couple weeks ago. But I'm amazed how quickly he got the right kind of help, and he got home and was recovering and went back to work very quickly. So we're very happy about that. And we're glad that it was caught when it was caught, because it was one of those things that certainly could have been worse or if he hadn't been around anybody. So we're thankful that he's doing really well, and we'll get him back up here on the podcast soon. So, Jamie, where do people find you?
Well, they can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media circles out there, and always here at the Disaster Podcast at disasterpodcast.com and on the Disaster Podcast Facebook page, Facebook group, as it were. And that you can join that group. Just go ahead to find it. Just search Disaster Podcast on Facebook and just request to join the group. We are more than happy to have you, and one of us will get in there and accept you and give you access so you can check out everything and comment and everything else. We want to hear from you. It's a great place to ask questions of each other. We've got a great group of people over there and tons of resources when you accumulate the years and years and years of experience and the people that are already part of the Facebook group. So check it out. Also, real quick, I just want to give a shout out to BJ Schneider, one of our regular guests here on the show. He started his own podcast about responders of various stripes who are also authors. And you can check that podcast out. It's just getting started here in the beginning of January. I think he's got 4 episodes up. And it's called Words Off the Street. And its website is wordsoffthestreet.com. So check it out. Subscribe to it. Find out a little bit about the different authors that are police officers, firefighters, EMS professionals, all varieties of responders that also write books, and it's pretty cool. So we want to thank BJ for branching out and starting his own podcast, and urge you to check it out.
Sam, we've
talked about a lot of stuff here this week, but it seems like we always come back to the medical topics and how things are a little different in these austere environments.
It is, and I've learned a lot of things tonight, or things I certainly haven't thought about in a long time. And we don't think of, like I said, we don't think about ski resorts having disasters as we typically define disasters. But this is just another good example of austere medicine is not our everyday medicine.